Hello, everybody, and welcome to the extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie All About Pocahontas. I am one of your hosts, the hardtack addict Bob Mackey, and who is here with me today, as always?
Collector of compasses, Henry Gilbert!
Yes, and we are smack dab in the middle of the What a Cartoon Movie Disney Renaissance Summer, the final one in our multi-phase installment, because we're simply out of Disney Renaissance movies by the end of the summer. But this month we are covering Pocahontas, the one that came smack dab in the middle of the 90s, one that is very polarizing, but when we revisited it for this podcast, we found that there's a lot to like and a lot that you probably forgot about.
I learned a whole lot, as the film wanted me to. As an ignorant white man, I learned so much, except this was about learning that Pocahontas was better than all of the think pieces told me it had been for so long, because I hadn't seen it in full since seeing it in theaters as a child in 1995.
So in this preview, you're going to hear a little bit of the two-hour history of Pocahontas, but if you want to hear the rest of the history and the entire six-hour podcast as a whole, you have to head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. And when you do, you'll unlock the rest of this podcast and also nearly 6 years' worth of What a Cartoon Movie podcast. They're all between 3 and 6 hours, although most of them have been 6 hours lately, covering so many different things. Pixar movies. By the end of the summer, we'll have covered every movie in the Disney Renaissance. Weirdo movies like Beavis and Butthead Do America and Rocko's Modern Life, Static Kling. Ghibli movies like Whisper of the Heart and Porco Rosso. There's so much going on there, and if there's an animated movie that you love and we haven't covered, we will likely cover it very, very soon in the future of What a Cartoon Movie. And that $10 level also gets you all the $5 stuff. Henry, what's going on the $5 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons?
Oh, there's so many awesome things there. First off, it gets you every episode of our regular free podcast a week ahead of time and without any ads in them, so that's already worth your $5. And then you also get monthly installments of our bonus podcast, Talking Future Futurama and Talk King of the Hill, where we cover Futurama and King of the Hill just as in depth as we do an episode of The Simpsons or a movie like Pocahontas. And you get our more than 7 years and 180 bonus podcasts we have in the back catalog of us covering every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, many of our favorite episodes of Batman the Animated Series, and tons of other cool stuff that has popped up over time at the $5 level.
And if you never signed up for Patreon before, it is so easy to do. And once you sign up, you can use any podcast app you might have to listen to our bonus content alongside our free content as part of your podcasting lifestyle. And there is a Patreon app for any smart device you might have. But either way you do it, it is so easy to access all of the bonus podcasts waiting for you at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Thank you so much for listening to this little ad. Now get ready to listen to this free preview. How long will this podcast go? If you don't subscribe, then you'll never know. I want to kick things off by telling you about the real story of Pocahontas. You must be 18. And also there will be a test. I'm going to try to make this not boring, but I found the history behind this to be fascinating. So at this point, I have to refer to Nelson's immortal quote, "Records from that era are spotty at best." So we are talking about a real life story that happened before photographs and film, of course. I shouldn't have to remind you of that, but we just grew up in an era in which media was a thing. Film, photographs, recordings, things like that. This is not happening in the era of John Smith and Pocahontas. And this also happened about 150 years after the invention of the printing press. So there's not a lot of information being spread by the printed page. So this is a very, very different era. And also, that's just on the white people's side. When you talk about the indigenous side of things, one side of this story comes from a people who passed history down through oral traditions, no written language. To this date, Pocahontas' people, only 14 words of their language remain. There are only 14 words that we know because, again, nothing got written down. This is not what they did.
Wow, man. That is as complicated a fable as a lot of the ones they take from in Disney films, except this one is more recent than, the 2,000-3,000 years ago of the Ballad of Fa Mulan, for instance, or 500, 600 years old of like the Little Mermaid story.
Yeah, and the unclear historical record gives them a lot of creative license. So we're left with a lot of spotty evidence as to what really happens. And basically what you believe boils down to who interprets the data best. And for this podcast, I read David A. Price's book, Love and Hate in Jonestown. Sorry, Jamestown. Jonestown, completely different. I don't know why I wrote that down. I was thinking of, I'm just thinking of genocides while watching this movie. I don't know why. So David A. Price's Love and Hate in Jamestown is an incredibly well-researched interpretation of the history of Jamestown, as well as Pocahontas and John Smith. Again, it is all up to who you believe. And then if you go online and you read listicles that are saying, here's what really happened to Pocahontas, I'm reading these and saying, well, this, the book I read contradicts everything here. And then I read Letterboxd reviews that say, well, here's the actual story. And I think, oh, this guy who cites everything argues differently. So again, it's all up to who you want to believe in this case. Actually, a lot of historical historians, that's a title, right? Well, they don't believe this happened at all. They don't believe this Pocahontas and John Smith thing happened at all. And Disney even points that out in their marketing at the time. They say, nobody knows what happened. Some people think it didn't happen. Therefore, we have creative license to kind of shape it into the story we think would fit these times best.
Well, and you know, we came up in the era of listicle writers too, and the video essayists who want to tell, you get a lot of easy engagement of saying, well, actually, the real thing is, and basically you, the message is, you were lied to when you were a child. Here's the real truth kind of thing. And it's usually something salacious. So I'm not surprised everybody, especially we've been on the other side of listicle writing. Like you got to get up that Pocahontas article in like 2 days.
Yeah, yeah. Like the difference between that and this book and a listicle is this guy's looking at, you know, the journals of John Smith and the books that he wrote in the 1600s, and other people are just like looking at IMDb trivia and, you know, skimming through some History Channel documentary someone uploaded to YouTube.
Right, right.
So yeah, some people think John Smith made up the story. Some people think he stole it from a popular Scottish ballad. Some people think he confused a friendly ritual with an execution ritual. But the author of that book I mentioned, which again, I really recommend you read if you want to know the full story, Price believes that the saving of John Smith actually happened.
Okay, all right. So this expert on it believes it was real to an extent, not just made up to sell John Smith our biographies.
Yes, yes. So that's just like an intro to things. Here is the real story. And again, I read a 300-page book about this. So this is going to be a brief recap of what the author interprets happened to these people in this place. Again, read the book. It's a fun read. So John Smith, he's a self-made, self-educated man. He had his first great adventure fighting with the Austrian forces in Hungary against the Turkish Empire. So this man, he led a crazy life. During this war, he was captured in present-day Romania, sold as a slave to a cruel Turkish master. Working in the fields one day, he turns on his master, beats him to death, steals his clothes, escapes on horseback. Even before Jamestown, Smith has been through a lot. He has been a slave.
Wow, that is really, that's an action film right there. Like that's an incredible adventure right there. This when I say John Smith in the movie comes off as kind of boring, when he talks about his adventures before, I can see why they don't tell that story in this movie that already is trying to shy away from being too sad about real history.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot going on with John Smith. He's in his late 20s. By the time he makes it to Jamestown, he's lived a life. So as the movie tells us, John Smith heads to the New World via the Virginia Company. That's a private enterprise with shareholders. King James did not get personally involved until much later. So Smith, he was hard-headed. He had a huge problem with the many gentlemen, in quotes, who were making the voyage with him. And during the voyage, another great John Smith adventure, he is imprisoned on one of the ships for much of the voyage, reportedly for plotting an insurrection. So he is chained up in the hull of the ship while the ship is making its final few months journey to America. So he's a troublemaker from the very beginning in the eyes of these gentlemen who are seeking fame and fortune, much like the Ratcliffe figure depicted in the movie.
So his overthrow of Ratcliffe or not listening to him is very fitting with the historical record of John Smith then.
Yes, yes. It fits his character. So John Smith's issues with the gentleman class of people would repeatedly land him in hot water in Jamestown. It would also severely limit his social climbing and opportunities when he went back to England. And it's also worth noting that, and this is surprising, and the author like really underlines this because readers frankly will not believe this, but Englishmen had a surprisingly progressive view of indigenous people of North America, even if it was only to differentiate themselves from the Spanish, who loved committing atrocities against indigenous people. We covered The Road to El Dorado. We told you what happens after the end of that movie. It's not good. So their opinion is that, like, listen, guys, we're not Spaniards. We're going to peacefully coexist with these people. We're going to live on land that they don't even want. And the general belief was, this is not a lesser race. These people just paint their skin and it stays that way. And the description of them as savages is just to describe the way they live, not their state of being, not like who they are, like their soul, their character. It's just, oh, it's kind of sad they have to live like this. Well, we can, you know, live next to them and share information, and we can, you know, all live peacefully. At least that was their idea at this point. We get more into colonization and genocide a little further down the road.
Wow. It's funny that it is positioned as they do look down upon the Spanish and Spaniards, and they define themselves as, we're better than them. We're not Spaniards in that, in their way of treating indigenous populations better than the Spanish do, which, yeah, I mean, Cortez was like a major character in Road to El Dorado, and he is not a joke at all. Like, yeah. He is only grim, horrible death.
And the funny thing is, unlike his depiction in the movie, Smith is actually the hard-headed guy who wants to use a firm hand against the Native Americans. He says, no, we can't play around with these people. They know more than us. They have the upper hand. We can't just wander in like sheep to the slaughter. He is the guy who is butting heads with people because he wants to be a little more firm. And everyone says, no, it's going to be all nice and peaceful. They're going to enjoy us. They'll welcome us.
Wow, man, that's so interesting.
Yes. Yeah. So that is John Smith. And then we have Pocahontas, who belonged to the Pamunkey tribe of the Powhatan chiefdom. So the Powhatan, that is a confederacy of tribes. Pamunkey is one of the tribes within the Powhatan confederacy. Pocahontas belonged to the Pamunkey tribe. So Pocahontas, her real name was either Amunute, and she also had a more private name, Mato'aka. So these are just other names she had. Pocahontas was a nickname given to her by her father. It means something like a little mischief or a little troublemaker because she was a little snarky. She, you know, was full of piss and vinegar and all that good stuff. So that's where Pocahontas comes from. It's just a nickname.
At first, it was mostly vinegar, right?
Yes, exactly. she was a favorite of her father, like in the movie, chief of the Pamunkey. So how does she meet John Smith? Well, John Smith is sent off by the Virginia Company to find a continental river passage. In other words, a river that would lead to the Pacific Ocean, because they knew the Pacific Ocean is somewhere on the other side of this continent. They didn't know how big America truly was. So they just told him, go find a river that leads to it and then come back when you do. And they assume, like, well, he'll probably die and good. But if he doesn't die, then we'll have a way to facilitate trade without having to go on this very long route.
And how long can one river be across this land? That's I kept thinking while watching this movie about a lot of the not drunk history, but the Hell on Earth podcast that our pals at Chapo Trap House did. And one of their points about America is, like, it's free real estate. That's what America is. And, like, mm-hmm. I was thinking that as they arrive to Jamestown in the movie. I was like, yeah, what you're not seeing is, like, they think there's gold everywhere. And it's like, no, it's free real estate. That's what you're getting. It's just so much stuff.
And harmless tobacco.
Yeah.
As far as the eye can see. So in the movie Pocahontas, everything takes place in like a day. It's crazy. They don't really call attention to that fact, but it's weird that they kind of arrive at sunup and then the movie ends the next morning and they go home. That's not what's going on in real life, because they land in Jamestown in May. This expedition John Smith goes on happens in November. By this point, the Englishmen have picked up a lot of experience dealing with Native Americans. Smith even picked up enough basic Algonquin to learn some basic ways to communicate with them. There are some shared languages between the tribes. He had picked up enough to trade and to learn where things are and things like that. So he had been meeting and talking to indigenous people well before this expedition. So at some point during this journey, Smith is captured by the Pamunkey tribe. He's able to stay alive by convincing them that he's very important, and he shows off his compass, which they find very impressive, just like in the movie. So he's held captive for a while, treated very well. At one point, he assumed that they would be eating him because they were just feeding him very well. And he's eventually led to what looks like a very important meeting with the chief Powhatan. And after much deliberation, the chief seemingly decides to club his brains out, though at the last second, his daughter Pocahontas intervenes. And notably, in the actual history, this event is Smith's first encounter with Pocahontas, who at this point is around 11 years old. Now, everyone was throwing out that fact when the movie was new. They're like, oh, I can't believe they depicted her as an adult. In the Making of Pocahontas special that aired on, like, the Disney Channel, the voice of Pocahontas says, now, Pocahontas was 11 years old at the time, so they're upfront about that. But in order to shape it into a Romeo and Juliet-style narrative, they've got to age her up a little bit.
So, wow. I did not know in all of the video essays or stuff I'd heard over the years, I had heard of her age brought up before in, like, you know, in Disney is so the real thing's so fucked up kind of stories. But I don't think I'd heard before that was the first time they met was her saving his life or that moment of saving his life, at least as it happens in the movie. Like, and I felt like in most stories about or kids' books about Pocahontas, it is like they knew each other and she saves him because she knows him. But instead, she saved a guy she didn't really know at first.
Yeah. She just took compassion upon this new type of person. Again, this is a different world, a different time when there are new kinds of people. Like, well, we're going to go to a place, you're going to meet a different kind of person you've never seen before. There aren't photographs. There are people telling stories about these new people, but you're going to see them for the first time. So it's just these cultures clashing that had no way of knowing about anything about each other. So that basically covers the events depicted in the film. So after saving John Smith's life, she becomes a friend of Smith's, visits Jamestown often to hang out with him in a completely non-romantic way. If you think otherwise, remember, at this point, she is a naked little girl. So if you want your accurate Pocahontas movie, it's going to be uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, I don't think if somebody wants to make that Pocahontas movie, they're going to get put on a list, not given a budget.
It's going to be hard to watch. Yeah, actually, I watched a lot of other movies for this just to learn more about indigenous people and also see different takes on this story. I watched Terrence Malick's movie, The New World, which is this movie's about 20% accurate. That movie's about 70% accurate. And the actress playing Pocahontas is 14. And they do still make it a romantic relationship because the idea is just too good. But they also put clothes on her because they understand, well, we're making a movie here.
Yeah.
People have got to see this movie.
Terrence Malick can only be so avant-garde.
Hey, if you have 3 hours and you enjoy Pocahontas, the story of Pocahontas and this movie, it's really good. It's really, really good.
Okay, you know what? I have not seen... I've seen, I think, all the other Terrence Malick films, which there aren't many, but I haven't seen that one because the length of it always did scare me off, but okay.
It is great. She goes to Jamestown. She's just so curious about these white people. She's kind of like a weeb for white people in a way. And they hang out a bunch. They become friends. Apparently he had a great deal of respect for her, but he was also in a very practical way able to learn a lot more about her language and culture through this friendship. So this goes on for a little bit of time until Smith is injured when his gunpowder bag explodes on him while he's sleeping. Many people believe someone was trying to murder him, and that seems very likely. So he heads home in October of 1609, a little after spending 2 years in the New World. At this point, the gentlemen of Jamestown really don't like John Smith. So when Pocahontas shows up, they're like, yeah, he's dead. Don't come back here. And she doesn't come back for 4 years. So that's all there is to John Smith and Pocahontas. And I can give you a brief summary of their lives after this. So as far as John Smith, he goes back to England. He goes on 2 more expeditions, this time to New England in 1614 and 1615. He never made it there on the second voyage. And then after this, he nearly came over again on the Mayflower with the Pilgrims, but it was clear they would not get along. So that never fell through. Or that did fall through. It never came into place, rather.
Wow. I guess if he already was getting into fights with, like, guys who just want to mine for gold, a bunch of guys who are too strictly religious for England in the 1600s, yeah, I could see that being too much for him.
Yeah, the book has a lot of fun stories about the Pilgrims in this little section. And then you find out just what a bummer they were, in that some of the reasons they left England were because, you know, the king made it legal to play sports on a Sunday. And they're like, that's the Lord's Day. And the king was like, listen, when else are people going to play sports? I'm an authoritarian, but you guys need to chill out.
Oh, that's so funny. Man, if nobody's done it yet, There should be a John Smith versus the Pilgrims movie now.
Oh,
him battling them.
That would be great. I want to see this. So after this, Smith never makes it back to America, but he wrote some very popular books about his voyage and then died at age 51 of unknown causes. So the reason we know about this in Pocahontas is that Smith's story becomes very popular in America around the time of the Revolutionary War, because it's a story of grit, determination, and gumption, which was important to a country just getting on its feet. And more importantly, it was a story of Pocahontas, the good Indian, how this man found the good Indian and how there was a connection between them. And in a way, it was like how he tamed her.
Yeah, no, I could see it being viewed as like a Taming of the Shrew type deal, or just like, yeah, it made a wild savage into a more proper person. And can't we do that with all of the savages in this world, quote unquote? Like, that makes sense that it spread as a fable would have been in the revolutionary times, when already like things are getting increasingly bad between the indigenous people of America and the colonizers and the children of colonizers who were slowly spreading throughout the what would become the United States.
Yeah, that is how it became a very popular folktale in the earliest days of America as we know it. So that is what happened to John Smith, dies at 51. Pocahontas. So 3.5 years after John Smith goes back to England, she's betrayed by a few members of her tribe and captured by the Virginia Company Deputy Governor Samuel Argall. So I believe they find some people from her tribe willing to sell her out, and I think she is traded for a brass or a copper kettle, like the thing you cook soup in. So that's what she was traded for. At some point before this, she probably marries a guy named Coquelin and probably bears one of his children, but that's very unclear. That's more unclear than anything else in this story. So they do pull that from the life of Pocahontas, but there are no concrete details about this guy and why he disappeared and if he died and if she had his kid.
Well, yeah, like there, I wouldn't think there would be a marriage license then, or what really, I mean, that would have been rare even in, like, you know, the English society back then of people having a marriage license like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So she is captured because, you know, she's a good bargaining chip when things are really breaking down between the English people and the Native Americans. So she's on this ship. She's being held captive. She begins a romance with a man named John Rolfe. By the way, there are a lot of Johns in this movie. There's John Smith. There's John Ratcliffe and John Rolfe. It's like a bathroom in here. There's so many Johns. So she begins a romance with him. Historians argue how consensual this was. You can make up your own mind. She converts to Christianity. She's given the Christian name Rebecca, and she marries John Rolfe. And again, it was a very wise political move to establish a brief era of peace between the settlers and the Powhatan tribe. So Pocahontas marries John Rolfe in 1614. They spend a few years in Jamestown. She has his son. They head to England in 1616. She becomes a minor celebrity there. Everyone is very excited to meet Pocahontas. And then in 1616, they decide to return to Virginia, but their ship does not even make it out of England before Pocahontas suddenly falls ill and dies of unknown causes at 21. So if you watch Pocahontas 2, know that minutes after the movie ends, she's dead.
Wow. That, man, that's a punch in the gut. Because I did watch Pocahontas 2 for the first time right after finishing it. Because it does, not to get ahead of it, but yeah, I did not look up, oh, how long did she live? Like, wow, yeah, she's, as soon as they leave England, she dies.
Mm-hmm.
Damn.
It's rough. And yeah, John Smith is in England. He hears his old friend Pocahontas is in town. He decides to go meet her. They have a very awkward meeting that John Smith says frustratingly little about. It sounds like it didn't go well. It was not very satisfying, and we don't really know how that resolved. But he did see her when she was in England. And yeah, unfortunately, with how little documentation there is of the story, the author has of the book I read had to make a lot of projections and suppositions and stuff like that, where there's a lot of phrases like, perhaps he was thinking this, or maybe this is why he did this, because we don't know. Nobody was writing a lot of this stuff down. So you have to look at the culture and judge like why certain things are happening or why certain people are acting in certain ways.
I have to say, John Smith then is a poor journalist that he did not properly catalog his, like, that's a whole nother book of like my return meeting with Pocahontas. Like, he wasn't thinking of book sales.
Yeah, some people think he was even embarrassed by the famous story of Pocahontas saving his life, and he only wrote it down because he knew his enemies would use it against him, his political and social enemies. So he wrote it down saying, yes, yes, this happened. Isn't this great? She saved my life. Anyway, it's a very small part of the things he wrote down about the New World.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can now that makes more sense why he back then, as a famous, strong, cool dude, people would use it like, yeah, did you hear like a little girl saved him once? What a pussy is what they're saying to each other in the pubs.
In the court.
In
the proper
yes.
court. So yeah, that's as much of the story as I can provide right now. Before we move on, I can give some details about Radcliffe, the villain of this story. He's really just a composite of all the gentlemen that Smith butted heads with, and he is one of the many elected governors that would lead Jamestown. It was a democratic process to decide who would lead the colony, and there were many leaders over time. So it's fun that democracy is happening in this little American colony that, you know, belongs to a monarchy at the end of the day.
That's to Jimmy, as Radcliffe calls him in the movie, which yes. was pretty funny.
King yeah. Jimmy. So Radcliffe either resigned or was forced to step down, and Smith took his place, but he immediately found a substitute because this is not the job he wanted. And then Radcliffe actually leaves Virginia in disgrace, comes back a few years later, and when he does, it doesn't take him long to get captured by the Powhatan, tied to a stake, and then skinned alive as they burned his flesh in front of him as they did at the time. And he gets off pretty easy in these films.
Whoa, wow.
Yeah.
That's nuts. Like, I did not, yeah, I thought that he, compared to other Disney villains at the time, like, that is worse than what happens to Scar at the end of The Lion King.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently this was the preferred cruel execution method of these people, where they would tie you up, they would sever all of your joints, and then they would skin you alive while burning the flesh in front of you. So lots of fun there.
Holy shit. I guess eventually you'll bleed to death?
You hope so. You hope yeah. so.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Man.
So Radcliffe, he just gets kind of embarrassed a few times throughout the course of these Disney films.
He's in the second movie, he's cast out of the court. He gets arrested by the king. That's as bad as it goes for him there.
And also, final word on this real history. Based on Price's book, there was a man named George Percy who feels like a much bigger antagonist to John Smith than Radcliffe ever was, but he is immortalized in the form of a pug in this movie. So they turn another one of Smith's adversaries into a cute Disney animal who becomes reformed by the end of the story.
It's rare when the cute sidekick animal stays the villain the whole time, when they instead accept, like, well, this guy can't be a bad guy the whole movie. We got to sell toys. They learned their lesson from Iago, where they had to wait until the sequel to make him a good guy.
Yes. So, yeah, I will say again, read Love and Hate in Jones. Fuck, I keep saying Jonestown. It's Jamestown. I know too much about Jonestown. I'm sorry. I'm a weirdo. So read Love and Hate in Jamestown or visit your local library. And I will say, you know, this reminded me how much I love reading about history because, you know, I read about history of video games and TV and movies and other things like that. But what about real history? It's great. I will say, every once in a while, back away from the listicle, back away from the YouTube essay, and just open a book that's well-researched, and it's very, very rewarding.
This is challenging me to pick back up reading the original Tarzan by Edgar Rice Burroughs, so I'm ready for next month.
I definitely want to read that. It doesn't seem like a long read.
Relatively. It's I think it's under 200 pages. I already have it set up in Kindle because it's a free download in the Kindle app.
Public domain.
Yep. Sweet, sweet public
well,
domain.
Well, there's a ton of Tarzan books. More on that next month. So, Pocahontas movie history time. Thank you. I hope you found the history of the real events fascinating as I did. Again, check out the book. It's so great. And
oh, yeah.
The movie The New World. Very, very good retelling of those events with some different changes that make it a better movie, a better story. So now the history of the movie. I want to note that a lot of it comes from the monstrously out of print and gigantic hardcover, The Art of Pocahontas. And I'm reaching around for it. Oh, it's right here by my feet. I'm holding it up on camera. It is very large.
Wow. Yeah. That is huge.
Oops, it's upside down. Sorry, Henry. It's very, very large. I have the one they made the year after this, the Art of the Hunchback of Notre Dame. This is courtesy of the Vancouver Library System, who lent me a pristine copy. They had it. So this book is fascinating. The best part of Pocahontas is the art. If you can find a copy of this, look in your library, look in your library system. It is great. Definitely worth checking out. And a lot of the official history comes from this.
I'm going to check out Internet Archive to see if that's on there, because that's where I found the Mulan one. Because, yeah, all of these giant art books are out of print. When we did Lion King, I did buy my, I'm looking over there at it. I did buy a copy of the Lion King one, which is a similar format, but that one was relatively cheap because I think they printed a lot more of them than Pocahontas.
Yeah, there were probably a lot of reprints of those. Those are probably some nice Christmas gifts of 1994.
Right, right.
So yeah, Pocahontas, the story begins, the movie story begins, when director Mike Gabriel is fresh off of The Rescuers Down Under, and he's collaborating with Disney legend Joe Grant on a follow-up project. And by the way, Joe Grant was born in 1908, and he was working on Mickey Mouse shorts in the early 1930s. So he ends up being a major force on this film, but he doesn't co-direct it because when this movie releases, he is in his mid-80s.
That he can be even that involved into his mid-80s is incredibly impressive. I don't fault him for not directing the film.
Yeah. Apologies. When he's working on the movie, he's in his mid-80s. When it releases, he's 87.
That is quite old. I mean, if you worked on original Disney shorts and can still do animation into the 90s, you're an impressively capable man.
And there are a lot of illustrations by Joe Grant in that Art of Pocahontas book. They don't look like they came from the hand of a 80-plus-year-old man. I'll say that.
That's impressive. Yeah, I know. Most people in their 80s don't continue into animation. Like, even the greats, they are not still working into their 80s. Usually they've passed away due to something that nationalized healthcare could have covered, mm-hmm. perhaps.
So, yes, this is Mike Gabriel and Joe Grant working together on something. We don't know what it is. It's not coming together. And Mike Gabriel is visiting his family for Thanksgiving. The idea of a Disney animated feature about Pocahontas suddenly dawns on him. Thanksgiving is a very good time to think about Native Americans, so it feels very appropriate. So he does some research, and he sees that historical opinions are very divided on what actually happened, like we talked about earlier, which means he's going to have a lot of creative license to tell this story the way that would fit best for Disney and for the go-go 90s.
That is a surprisingly different thing to with Beauty and the Beast. You do have like this original story that you can go back to with Pinocchio. There is the book Pinocchio, and that's the original story. With The Little Mermaid, it's that one Hans Christian Andersen story that's at the root that you can say, well, this is the original thing. But now that I've learned from what you've explained, like, it is so vague, there is not one definitive version of the Pocahontas story before this.
So Mike Gabriel pitches this story idea at Disney's Gong Show. And I know we've talked about these before, but in case you forget, these are regular pitch meetings with Michael Eisner in which anybody from any level at the company can pitch ideas. And it's all very fast paced. There's a lot of ideas. There's a lot of pitches happening in this room. And Mike Gabriel pitches this as a take on Romeo and Juliet. And it was the fastest a pitch was ever put into production by this point in Disney history. Interestingly enough, Walt Disney Feature Animation had been kicking around the idea of adapting Romeo and Juliet, and the story of Pocahontas felt like the best way to interpret it for the era, especially as conversations about race and discrimination were starting to resurface in popular culture.
If they were going to do literally Romeo and Juliet, like, there is implied premarital sex and also, you know, suicide and murder. Like, you can't, it's hard to cut those out of a Romeo and Juliet adaptation.
Yes. But apparently, what really sold everybody on this idea was just a drawing that Mike Gabriel did. He drew Tiger Lily from Peter Pan, and he put the words Walt Disney's Pocahontas over it. And they were like, well, this makes sense. This makes perfect sense. And I think they're also thinking, boy, it's the 90s. We really need to fix this thing that's happening in Peter Pan. We need to address it by making another movie.
That is, speaking of listicles, what makes the red man red has long lived on listicles as in the list of most racist Disney things.
With all the things they've changed at Disneyland, I am shocked that when I ride the Peter Pan ride, which is not often, they still have that depiction of Native Americans in the ride. Unless it was changed recently, which I'm not sure if it was.
I wish I could say I should look this up. Maybe if we ever do Peter Pan, I'm sure we'll learn then. But I never ride that ride because it has one of the longest lines of lowest return of line to good ride to me. Like, it takes forever. I can hop on the right next door to it, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, and be done with it in like 10 minutes. But Peter Pan is such a slow ride, like you're waiting way longer.
The only one I put off of the old creaky rides is Alice in Wonderland. I think I remember that one being painful.
Yeah, actually, I have not ridden that one either. I do. I sometimes do the teacups, though not always. But the actual Alice storybook one, no.
I've done it like twice, and I think I'm good. Maybe if it ever goes away, I will jump on it again. But yeah, back to Pocahontas, though. Mike Gabriel had big, big things in store for this movie. Here's a quote about the Finnish film from Mike Gabriel. Quote, "Ignorance and bigotry are taught. If Colors of the Wind or this movie makes one child begin to question, anyone who teaches hatred and fosters misunderstanding, that will be a wonderful thing." So this is very appropriate for the decade they're launching this. This is such a relic of the 90s, but it's also very naive and charming in a 90s way to think that this movie could have that impact. Hell, maybe it did, but I really like how well-intentioned they are, how much they thought this movie could change the world.
Having just watched Encanto, I was thinking about how the creatives who came up in the generations after Pocahontas, they make movies trying to address generational trauma because they see how that has affected families, including their own, for you know, years and years and years. Similarly, this does feel like boomers who grew up with playing cowboys and Indians and the game cowboys and Indians with each other, and maybe they go too far the other way with, you know, the crying Indian commercials and all that, but it is an attempt, it feels like, to address the racism or prejudices towards Native Americans they grew up with, perhaps.
Yeah, and this is all happening also around the time when Columbus Day is being reevaluated. It's the, I think, 500th anniversary of Columbus Day, and there were a lot of conversations happening in 1992 as this is all getting kicked off.
It feels like Columbus Day is about dead now, right?
It does feel like it. I think it really does. For the past, I don't know, 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, though, I'm sure there are still people who very aggressively celebrate Columbus Day to not let it go away.
Yes.
But
and I'm sure there's a Sopranos episode about that, isn't there, Henry?
It's one of the preachiest. No, it is the it's Ziggy level preachy episode. It's also a fun episode, but it is the closest an episode is to just being like a fable about Columbus Day and Italian Americans.
Oh, Tony, will you ever win? So at this point, I'll just let everybody know that I'm going to give bios later for all the people I'm mentioning. So just hang in there if you get lost, just to keep the history flowing. So it sounds like Alan Menken and Stephen Schwartz were brought in first, and their Oscar winning song, Colors of the Wind, was one of the first things written, and it establishes the tone and the themes of the film. So that was their roadmap. Colors of the Wind was written first, and then the rest of the movie and music followed. And you can watch on the DVD, which I also got from the library, by the way. Great resource. Go to the library. You can see an early presentation reel from 1992 that features a lot of production art and a demo version of Colors of the Wind. Notably, it says Pocahontas will be releasing in fall of 1994. So they had a different schedule in mind. This is also before Disney films were becoming summer films. The Lion King, because of delays, wasn't that one of the first, if not the first?
Yeah, and only because of the delay. It was supposed to be the Christmas 93 movie, but it turned into summer 94, and then it made so much money, it switched to summer. I think also, too, that was part of the transition of, if we have a summer release, then it's a VHS at Christmas instead of Christmas to Christmas. That takes too long when you could do a six-month turnaround on to the VHS release.
So I have no other place to say this, but I do want to point out one minor lyrical difference in the song that's on the presentation reel, which is just Colors of the Wind, sung by the same singer. We'll talk about her later. But the final lyric towards the end of the song is, "You'll own this earth and still, all you'll own is earth until." That's the final lyric. The original lyric was, "Your life will be an empty hull till you get it through your skull," which I'm glad they changed that. It feels that song is so poetic, so beautiful, but that's just so blunt. It does not feel like the language she would be using. So that's just one minor change that the DVD documents just by having the original version available.
That's very interesting. I can see how Colors of the Wind does give a good North Star for what you're working toward. That, you know, compared to Mulan, where it felt like they were searching forever for what the spine of the story was and where they were going with it. Colors of the Wind sets the tone of the whole like reflection, I think they finally found, but even that, they cut that song in half. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it ends very quickly in that movie. So the movie's getting off the ground and more talent is being brought on. So we have Mike Gabriel and Joe Grant running the show. And then Eric Goldberg signs on to direct alongside Mike Gabriel. We'll talk more about Eric Goldberg later. By January of 93, the first screenwriter is brought on, and then two more join the production by May. And all in all, it took 18 months and 14 drafts before the script reached its final form.
This, I noted, but this is pretty standard. A lot of story by credits on this one,
yes,
too.
And according to Goldberg on the 2003 Disney DVD commentary, quote, "This was the most unforgiving, difficult to draw movie ever done at Disney."
Wow, that's and he would know. He worked on a lot of them.
And yeah, going back to what I was saying earlier,
it's not a comedy.
Goldberg says in the Art of Pocahontas, quote, "Comedy was thrown out of the entire movie until people felt comfortable with the drama." President of Walt Disney Feature Animation, Peter Schneider, opened the door a crack by saying something like, "John Smith seems a little square in this sequence. Is there anything he could do or say that's a little lighter, a little funnier?" So he credits Peter Schneider with allowing some levity in this serious drama. It's mostly offloaded to the animal characters, because if you look at the deleted scenes on the DVD and on Disney Plus, there were a lot more scenes of Wiggins and a lot more pratfalls, a lot more mud in the face, a lot more gags, and they're almost all out of the movie.
Wow. Yes, the comedy does feel a lot more tamped down, or I'm used to cutaways to your animal sidekicks, and three animal sidekicks is about the maximum, but that is most like Ariel had three animal sidekicks as well, Scuttle, Sebastian, and Flounder. So then they could all talk. So they took up a lot more space than Miko, Flick, and Percy do.
They certainly do. And a huge artistic force on this film is Glenn Keane, who was, I can remind you, the lead animator for characters like Ariel, Aladdin, The Beast, and Tarzan, the topic of next month's What a Cartoon Movie. He's a great animator. He's chosen to be the lead animator for Pocahontas, the character, ends up storyboarding a lot of the most pivotal scenes in the movie featuring this character. And apparently when he started storyboarding and sketching with a charcoal pencil, it really unlocks something for him, which is why he was allowed to do one cut of the Colors of the Wind sequence in charcoal. It's the scene that looks nothing like anything else in the movie or in that sequence. And that is a Glenn Keane original. It's like, what if we did this? We've never done this. And it's one of the most striking parts of that very good sequence.
It's an amazing shot, but also I knew it wouldn't last long when it started, because I was like, man, even at Disney's budget, they can't animate for this long. It would be too time consuming. But yeah, I definitely see the Glenn Keane in her. When I saw his credit in there, like he has a very specific way of drawing beautiful women, and Pocahontas is incredibly striking as a character. Like she is a very pretty, like I remember back in the 90s when people would joke about like, oh, she's supposed to be 11-year-old girl and they turned her into like a Vogue fashion model.
Yeah, speaking as the straight guy in this podcast, auga auga, wolf howl.
Her facial structure does not follow the normal or what is defined as the cute girl or Disney princess. I mean, the white Disney princess look. Like she has very different angles to her nose and chin and cheekbones than they go with for the previous princesses.
Yeah, there is a little featurette on the DVD of Glenn Keane drawing the character before the movie has even come out. He's just showing an audience, here's what Pocahontas looks like. And he's using Ariel as a point of comparison, where he's showing Ariel and he's showing every feature on Pocahontas' face is different in the most opposite possible way. So Ariel's eyes do this, her eyes do that, her forehead does that, Pocahontas' forehead does this. He's just showing the audience, like, we are having to draw characters with non-white features this much for the first time for a lot of these animators.
No, that's cool. That's I want to check out. Maybe that one's on the YouTube. I'm gonna check that out.
And you know, we criticize the movie for making her extremely hot, but then I'm also reading a lot of, you know, perspectives from Native Americans and Indigenous people saying this was important that she was not only the star of the movie, but she was incredibly pretty. That meant a lot to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, too, like one need only watch F Troop to see that pretty Native Americans are, they sometimes get sexualized and stuff, but usually it's like, oh, look at these ugly red face guys or whatever, the horrible racist things.
Glenn Keane says about the movie, quote, "This movie required acting that was so delicate. It required artists to draw better than we've ever drawn. I used to think that animation was about moving stuff. In order to make it really great, you bounce it, squash it, stretch it, make the eyes go big. But as time went on, I started loving animating character who had such a burning passion in her heart. Suddenly, animation became, for me, not so much about moving stuff as it was about moving the audience." So this was a major challenge for everyone involved. All the acting is subtle. Pocahontas' features are very stylized, but these are mostly fairly realistic characters, especially John Smith.
Yeah, John Smith, his design honestly reminds me of Beast after he's transformed back. But, I mean, he's John Smith. You don't get more regular white guy than John Smith as a name.
Yeah, again, too many Johns. So I want to point out that they did do a lot of research. They brought in American Indian advisors to consult on the film. Keane met with daughters of a Powhatan chief to learn about what he should do when creating the character of Pocahontas, the visual design of the character. Though, an Entertainment Weekly article of the era has Keane citing supermodel Christy Turlington as a huge influence on Pocahontas' design. If not her face, then her bodacious bod. And Keane in the article says, quote, "We're doing a mature love story here, and we've got to draw her as such. She has to be sexy," says Keane, who likens her to a tribal Eve. "This is a Disney movie. This is not a documentary," is what he says. So I am so glad that to this day, God forbid anything happens, you can read an Entertainment Weekly article that was posted in 1995.
That's impressive. It's still online. Yeah, I also am impressed that, again, the family, the son of the family circus creator is a horny guy. He's not as sexless as his dad.
I forgot that about him. Yeah. He's little Glennie.
He is. Yes, it's so funny to think about that he is a nepo baby of art, but also you have to be, unlike, say, acting or whatever, you actually do have to be good at drawing to be a nepo baby artist.
And if you're in the studio wondering where Glenn Keane might, you just follow the dotted line and you'll get to him eventually. Now, family circus heads know what I'm talking about.
I would bet he had to hear that every day in art school his entire life, and probably he loved hearing it from all the other wags down at CalArts.